Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of Kicking with Kior here on Full Press Radio, episode number 104. Thanks for kicking with me, Ricky Kior, here on another Thursday afternoon. We've got a big show coming up for you, of course. We're going to get into all the serious news of the week, the resignation by John Gruden, and the aftermath of the emails that were reported that Gruden has sent over the last few years. We'll talk about, of course, the seriousness of that story. Kyrie Irving's on Instagram Live talking about why he's not vaccinated and why he won't get the vaccine. We talked about that constantly on the show, but we'll dive into exactly what Kyrie said and what it all means. We'll, of course, look back at the week in the NFL as we head into another week, as we begin week six tonight, Tampa Bay at Philadelphia. We'll give a quick preview of that. College football in full swing. Look back at the crazy week that was, including Alabama going down. What's it mean for the college football playoff? Hockey opening night. I will talk some hockey. I did watch some hockey. I'll give you my thoughts on how ESPN and TNT did their first nights, splitting the rights to the NHL this season, and a couple big baseball, postseason baseball in full swing. Astros and Red Sox are your ALCS. That begins Friday night. We'll, of course, recap game one on our show on Saturday. And tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern on TBS, Dodgers-Giants, game five, winner-take-all. Two of the best teams in baseball. They played 23 times. Giants are 12-11 in those games. So tonight's a huge game. The Dodgers making a weird decision on who starts game five. And I'll tell you why. It might work out, but it makes us go back to the days of yesteryear and wishing we had iconic pitching duels this time around. Want to remind you, you can follow me on Twitter, AdvocateNader555. It's at R-A-C-K, letter I, Nader like a Terminator, and three fives. You can follow us on Twitter at FP underscore coverage and at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, wherever it's your podcast. Just search Kicking with Kior. Chances are you will find it. And be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free. All of our articles, live shows, podcasts are there, including our FPC NHL preview show. The Pick and Roll NBA show, FBC NFL Sunday, which you can catch. I'm on with this week. Ian Glendon is off because he's celebrating his birthday. Happy birthday, Ian. Kyle Stenmer, Brayton Halichuk, and I'll be on the show Sunday previewing the day's games and so much more here on the network. Or you just want to listen to this show again and hear what I had to say. It's all on the app, so we thank you for downloading the app today. So let's get into the story. We didn't really get too much into it last Saturday, but it really was a bombshell during the game against the between the Colts and the Ravens Monday Night Football. John Gruden announced his resignation as the head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders after emails were reported in the New York Times, a leak that Gruden had made homophobic and misogynistic remarks, said racist things about Damaris Smith, the NFLPA union leader. This was back in, it was reported in 2011, and at the time people thought, well, this is back in 2011. Can you really fire a guy that hasn't that from something from 10 years ago? And he was working in the NFL. He's working for ESPN at the time. And then it came out that there had been in the investigation into the Washington football team's workplace misconduct. Gruden sent messages to Bruce Allen, who was then the president of the football team. Gruden said a gay slur about Michael Sam, Roger Goodell. And at some point you talk about an over 7 year period when there's 650,000 emails, there was no choice. No choice at all. And I liked what Derek Carr said in his press conference on Wednesday. Love the man, hate the sin. You can still have a good relationship with John Gruden, but realize what he did was wrong. And there are certain people you feel for, one being somebody like Reggie McKenzie, who was the Raiders GM when Gruden got there. Gruden got rid of him, hired Mike Mayock. Art Shell was, of course, the first African-American head coach for the Raiders. You had Carl Nassib, an openly gay player on the Raiders football team. How do you think he feels? He had the request to take a personal day, and the Raiders granted it. Because he doesn't know how to view this situation. And if you're the NFL, you have to, like, now people I understand are skeptical with the NFL because what else is in these emails? Will we ever see the light of day on these emails? Is it just a John Gruden thing? Is it just a Vegas thing? Which I don't believe it is. Or is it a league-wide problem with workplace misconduct? And the NFL is Teflon. We know that. We all watch the games and we all enjoy Sundays and Thursdays and Mondays and all that stuff. And it's great. But at some point, the NFL has got to be careful. And when you look at ownership, Mark Davis takes a lot of blame here. He's, of course, the owner of the Raiders. He's the son of the late, great Al Davis. And when asked about the resignation from John Gruden on Wednesday, he said, "I have no comment. Ask the NFL. They have all the answers." That's not good enough. That's not good enough. And I get it. Mark Davis is upset because they basically had to get rid of his best friend. Get rid of a guy that he always wanted to hire as the head coach. I understand that. But you're supposed to be the spokesperson for your football team. You have to have a better statement than that, man. To put it the onus on the rest of the NFL, that's weak. Like, make a statement for your football team. Do what Mike Mayock did yesterday. I thought Mike Mayock's words are powerful when he spoke to the media. And have a word of support for the new Raiders interim head coach, Rich Bisaccia. You've got to say more than you have no comment, ask the NFL. And I'm sure Roger Goodell was not happy about that either. We know the Raiders is a renegade franchise, obviously. At times they were viewed as a renegade franchise. But something has to change. I think everybody knows it. And I don't believe it's strictly a John Gruden problem. I don't believe he's the one rogue guy that kind of thinks the way that he thinks. But it's our job as a society to continue to help somebody when they think these things and try to fix them, and also not quickly ostracize them either. Don't get me wrong, he deserved to lose his job in this case. Because how is he supposed to interact with his team after when those emails leak like that? You can't. Because there are players that would never look at him the same way ever again. And I don't blame them. There are players that couldn't have the same relationship with him again. And I don't blame them. We'd all think that way. And it also comes down to, I was kind of thinking this when we talked about this game on Sunday on the FPC show. And I said, I don't know how distracted the Raiders are by this news. And when you think about it, I know Mike Mayock said that Mark Davis was doing his due diligence. When asked why was Gruden allowed to coach Sunday's game, and my answer was, if you just fired him the day after, or Gruden resigned the day after, I should say, excuse me, he didn't get fired, but why is he not placed on a temporary suspension or something like that? Like, if you know this stuff is out there and you're continuing to look into it, at some point, why don't you just say, even if it's Saturday night, John Gruden's not coaching today, and let the process play out. But what else is on those emails? And remember, that Washington investigation was an oral presentation of the findings. There's no written findings out there. What was in that investigation? The NFL leaked out what they wanted leaked out in that investigation. You have to think, if you're just looking at it from afar, there's something out there in that investigation that's never going to be known that they found out. And I was listening to, I think it was a Michael Kay show or something like that. One of the shows, like, what do you think was, like, remember that lawsuit with Colin Kaepernick? Why do you think they didn't want to go to court with that? Got to have discovery. Got to have findings. And you never know what might pop up. We all have things with emails, things like that. Sometimes we wish we didn't send out. You obviously don't want that put out there. At the same time, you have to be careful with what you put out there, anything public. And you have to be careful, really, of, I'm trying to think of the right word here. You have to have a awareness of what's around you. I don't think Mark Davis has the awareness of how serious the situation is. Because if he did, he would have had a better comment to ask the NFL. And obviously, we condemn the words of John Gruden. Obvious, that's point blank. We heard Keyshawn Johnson this week call John Gruden a fraud. And you have to take Keyshawn's words at face value because Keyshawn played for the guy. And Keyshawn probably knew all along what he was like as a coach, as a person. Maybe not to this extent, but you have to consider that into account as well. But the NFL has egg on its face as much as John Gruden does, as much as the Raiders seem to have right now, but I don't think it's a strictly Las Vegas Raiders problem. And I don't think it's strictly a John Gruden issue either. There's more to the story than we know. And it's going to, as the days and weeks and months go on, you'll find out more about the story probably. Reporters will do their job, they'll dig into it, and they'll find some things. You would think they'd find some things. The question is, what exactly will they find? I think we'll find out in due time. So we'll take our first break. We'll come back. We'll look back actually at week 5 in the NFL, some of the great games, some of the great storylines. And we will also, I'm going to actually turn it into two segments. Well, two things into one segment. We'll do NFL and college football in our second segment. Our third segment will be all Kyrie. And then segment 4, wrap it up with hockey. And a little bit of the baseball. So all football talk on the field coming up next on Kicking with Keeler episode 104 here on the Full Press Radio Network. We'll be right back. Turning our attention to on the field NFL action from week 5 here on Kicking with Keeler in our second segment of the show. And I think it's fair to start with the game between the Colts and the Ravens. Because this was the game going on as the Gruden story was being reported he was resigning. And the Ravens were down in this game big, 25-9, 12 minutes left in the fourth quarter. They get up the 76-yard touchdown to Jonathan Taylor. And what I think about this game is I still don't know what to think of the Ravens. Because they're 4-1. They've won 4 in a row since that opening loss to Vegas. I think they're a good team, and it also shows you that, again, if we're doing MVP, and again, I'm not doing MVP till probably like early November, Lamar Jackson's got to be in the conversation because they don't have a running game. Their running backs outside of Lamar Jackson ran for 24 yards. They don't have a running game. Their running game is Lamar Jackson. And then he brought them back via passing the ball, 37-43, 442, 4 touchdowns. 0 interceptions. He did have the fumble on the goal line, but didn't throw any picks. You saw Hollywood Brown get involved, actually hung onto the ball, 9 catches on 10 targets. Mark Andrews, 11 catches on 13 targets. Both Andrews and Brown had a pair of touchdowns, including the touchdown by Brown in overtime. And yes, the Colts missed a couple of field goals. It was a league-wide problem in week 5. People just couldn't make field goals and extra points. But what exactly are the Ravens? You think of their wins, and yes, they beat the Chiefs. I think we're still trying to figure out what the Chiefs are. They beat Detroit. A lot of people thought the Lions got robbed in that game. They did beat Denver, but Teddy Bridgewater left the game in the second quarter with a concussion. And then this Colts game. I think we still have a ways to go to figure out the Ravens. I think that's going to start this week when Baltimore hosts the Chargers in a battle of 4-1 teams. Baltimore's next few games are L.A. and Cincinnati. So at least those are two teams above 500. We'll find out a little bit more. But you look at the Ravens' schedule going forward, they don't have many games left. Well, they have actually their schedule in the season is pretty tough. You look at their December, Cleveland, Green Bay, Cincinnati, L.A., Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh's not what they once were, but it's still a rivalry series, and they play them twice in the last 6 games of the year. So I still think we have a little ways to go to figure out Baltimore, like how good is their defense? But for right now, Lamar Jackson is putting the team on his back, and he's absolutely delivering. Then you had Sunday Night Football, which to me was a big surprise. And I'll give a lot of credit to the Bills. This was a game I thought they needed to prove something, go to Arrowhead, And I thought if they played a clean game for 60 minutes and didn't win, they would make a statement that way. They took it to the Chiefs. Josh Allen throws for 315 yards, 3 touchdowns, runs for a score. And it's the same problem with the Chiefs. Patrick Mahomes turned over twice, but Kansas City has no defense. And they don't really have a running game. Now with Clyde Edwards-Helaire on the IR, you're relying on Darrell Williams, you're relying on Jerick McKinnon. And that's somewhat of an issue for Kansas City still. They can't run the football consistently. Chiefs running backs outside of Patrick Mahomes ran for 40 yards. And at some point, you have to have a running game. Now, the Bills, they don't really run the ball that well either. Moss and Singletary ran for 52 yards, 62 yards. But Josh Allen at least is a runner. He ran 11 times with a score. But that's a big win for the Bills. And right now, you have to say they're the best team in the AFC, and what is a deep AFC. And the Chiefs, I don't think they're done. But this defense probably has more ways to be corrected than everybody thought that they did. And Patrick Mahomes is not going to get away with the same things he's gotten away with over the last couple years. Teams are starting to figure it out. Teams are getting those turnovers. And if Mahomes turns the ball over, he has to play basically perfect football because the Chiefs can't trust their defense right now. So when you have that pressure of having to play a clean game and maybe making a throw, you don't want to make a throw, but you're trying to at least get something started, that adds up at some point. I think it's not full-blown panic for the Chiefs, but at 2-3, they really need to right the ship and right it in a hurry. A couple of the more interesting games from Week 5, Packers winning in overtime in Cincinnati. Joe Burrow, scary moment he left the game in the second quarter with the injury. Does have a throat issue now, but it sounds like he's going to play this week. But Burrow to Ja'Marr Chase is one of the better quarterback-to-wide receiver combos in the NFL. And give the Packers credit, finding a way to win in overtime. Mason Crosby missed a couple of kicks in regulation. No T, hits a 49-yarder. Green Bay gets a big win on the road. And we think back to Week 1, a lot of people thought doom and gloom for the Packers. They got blown out by the Saints, but since then they've won 4 in a row. So Green Bay is starting to find it, and that's not an easy win on the road. Cincinnati, maybe they're not a contender for the Super Bowl, but they're definitely a playoff contender, and I think they showed that against the Packers. And we've talked about it in the last couple weeks. Cincinnati's schedule sets up for them in the next couple weeks where they should be no worse than 5-3. One of the more entertaining games of the week was out in L.A., the Chargers' 47-42 win over the Browns. I thought we'd see more defense in this game, but the two teams combined for 41 points in the fourth quarter. I thought the Browns had good success running the football. Nick Chubb ran for 161 and a score. Kareem Hunt ran for 2 touchdowns. Baker Mayfield didn't have an interception. But I think you look at the Browns, and I don't get why people are still doubting Baker Mayfield. Like, I've seen all week that Baker Mayfield can't lead the Browns to a Super Bowl off of one failed fourth quarter drive. Mayfield played as good a game as you could play on the road in L.A. And Odell Beckham is still not 100%. Not involved in this offense to a degree that you'd want him to. David Njoku had a big game. Donovan Peoples-Jones had 5 catches. I think he's starting to emerge, but maybe the Browns could use an extra playmaker on offense. Of course, without Jarvis Landry, they don't have that many playmakers. And their defense did give up 26 points in the fourth quarter. So before we go blaming Baker Mayfield, remember Week 1, the Browns had a 9-point lead and KC in the fourth quarter couldn't hold the lead. And then on Sunday, Browns led 27-13, 12-18 to go in the third, then led by 7 on 2 different occasions in the fourth quarter, could not hold the lead against Justin Herbert, who did throw for nearly 400 yards and 4 touchdowns. But there's more problems for Cleveland, or at least more concerns, than Baker Mayfield right now. You could look at him long-term and say maybe he's not the answer, but I don't think you can go that off the Charger game and off of one drive in the fourth quarter. Because the defense has to eventually make some stops for Cleveland. They did it last week against Minnesota. They held the Vikings to 7 points a couple weeks ago. But to go from allowing 7 to allowing 47, I think I'm a little more concerned with Cleveland's defense than their offense. Chargers, they've had some big wins over the last few weeks. Really, they should have beat Dallas. They had some bad penalties, some bad turnovers. But clearly you're seeing when Herbert has an offensive line, And that's where drafting Rashawn Slater in the first round was huge for them this year. He's going to get the time. He's going to make the throws to Keenan Allen, make the throws to Mike Williams, use Eckler in the passing game. And as long as everybody's healthy, that's a fine-tuned machine on offense. Dallas with a 44-20 win over the Giants. Cowboys have won four straight. Really, they could make the case for 5-0 because they kind of had a chance to beat Tampa Bay and could not come up with that final stop. Now, the Giants, they had a bunch of injuries. Saquon Barkley left the game in the second quarter. Daniel Jones gets a concussion. Kenny Galladay leaves the game. Giants are a mess, but Dallas looked like what they're supposed to be. Ezekiel Elliott and Tony Pollard are that good 1-2 combination. Dallas ran as a team for over 200 yards. And that takes a lot of pressure off Dak Prescott when you can do that. Because now it gives him more time to hit Amari Cooper, to hit CeeDee Lamb. Dalton Schultz has emerged this year as a tight end option. Dallas is starting to become more consistent, starting to get in that upper tier echelon of the NFC when you look at Tampa and the Cardinals and the Rams and Green Bay, I think, has to be there. Like, those are five teams right now that have separated themselves. Dallas is putting themselves in that tier. Yes, it's the Giants, but that game has a history of being close. So Dallas deserves credit for blowing out the Giants. Other games of note, I was disappointed in Carolina. Three picks by Sam Darnold. Still no Christian McCaffrey for the Panthers. Maybe that's why they lost this game, but Carolina's defense could not get the stops on Jalen Hurts when they needed it. So the Eagles get a huge win, especially going into tonight's game against Tampa. You had the other games of note. Saints go on the road to Washington to get a win. So good job by Jameis Winston and Sean Payton of bouncing back. Arizona was ugly. Trey Lance got hurt in this game. Luckily, the Niners have a bye. Cardinals defense wins them the game against San Francisco. They're still 5-0. They got a tough game in Cleveland this week. We'll talk more about that game on Saturday. Pittsburgh loses Juju Smith-Schuster, but two touchdowns from Ben Roethlisberger, 100-plus yards on the ground from Najee Harris. They get a big win in Denver, well, home against Denver, I should say. And, I mean, I have to throw in the Patriot game because obviously I like the Patriots, and that was an ugly game for both teams. It looked like both teams wanted to lose the game, and you could hear the Patriots' comments afterwards. They knew they were outplayed, but they found a way to win. Now, I'm a little concerned they didn't really bring that same effort that they brought against Tampa the week before. As just a reminder, this is not the Brady Patriots anymore. You can't just assume they're going to come and bring the A game every week. Because it's not... That's a different standard. There's not that standard anymore. Yes, the Patriots won the game, and I still, again, would like to see Mac Jones throw the ball down the field. Give him some chances. Stop running the ball in first down. Stop being too conservative. You know Jones can make the throws. He made an excellent throw to Hunter Henry for the game-tying touchdown in the fourth quarter where they finally scored a touchdown in the red zone. Let Mac Jones do his thing, and if he makes mistakes, he makes mistakes. But maybe it's time that Josh McDaniels takes the training wheels off. Maybe playing Dallas, maybe isn't the game to do that because this Sunday, because you got Trayvon Diggs, who's probably a defensive player of the year. But it's still frustrating, especially New England's defense. I think what's frustrating with the Patriots is that their defense and their offensive line, which were supposed to be the strength of their football team coming into the year, just have been weaknesses. And you could forgive the Patriots, well, let's say the quarterback play was the weak point because it is a rookie. But you go down the list in terms of weaknesses before you get to Mac Jones. You look at defensive line play, you look at offensive line play, wide receivers. It goes further down. New England's not a playoff team. So I think they have a tough time going home this week to play the Cowboys. Patriots, by the way, are in danger of dropping to 0-4 at home if they lose this week. That hasn't happened in a long time. So very quickly, we'll look at tonight's game. Buccaneers at the Eagles, Tampa. Of course, the last time Tom Brady played in a Thursday night game during the season, not counting opening night, of course, was the loss in Chicago last year. We forgot how many downs there were. I still don't trust this Eagles team. I know they got a big win on the road last week, as we just mentioned, but the Eagles still don't run the ball. They still don't have a good balance, and I think if you're going to want to beat Tampa Bay and you want to hold Tom Brady to a limited amount of possessions, you have to use more of Miles Sanders. You have to use more of Kenneth Gainwell. You can't simply rely on Jalen Hurts to win these games. And can Philly's defense get a turnover or two on Tom Brady, maybe get a short field to maybe get that quick touchdown that they need to kind of keep the spark going at home where the crowd's going to be on their side? Right now, even though Rob Gronkowski's out, Levante David's out, Antoine Winfield's out, so that's your tight end, one of your top linebackers, one of your top safeties. And I think Hurts will have success with Devontae Smith tonight, especially Tampa's secondary is not their strongest point. Tom Brady right now is just in a rhythm, 15 touchdowns, 2 picks this year, and you're seeing more of Leonard Fournette in this offense. And Tampa doesn't have to be a dominant running team. They just have to have enough success in the running game to at least limit teams on playing solely the pass. And you saw Gio Bernard come back and make an impact, at least on third down. He had the big touchdown early in the game against the Dolphins. He'll help. I like Tampa tonight. I don't see how Philly wins this game. I just think the Eagles right now are not where they should be. They kind of got fortunate against the Panthers last week to get a win. The Eagles might be the team playing more desperation because, again, they're 2-3. Dallas is 4-1. The Eagles can't really afford to lose a lot more games if they want to stay in the mix for the NFC East. But Tampa Bay right now has just got everything clicking. Antonio Brown's back. You have, even though no Rob Gronkowski, but again, Mike Evans is clicking. Chris Godwin is clicking. They've got the good mojo going here for Tampa Bay. So I like Tampa tonight over the Eagles. I think Tampa's favored by 7. I think Tampa wins by 10. Then to college football. And of course, the big story from college football this week, Alabama loses to Texas A&M. In a game, I was shocked. I thought this game would be a blowout. Alabama was in good form. They had blown out Ole Miss the week before. And A&M wins on a last-second field goal by Seth Small. But Alabama's defense could not stop Zach Calzada. 3 touchdowns, 1 interception. A&M had the 96-yard kickoff return for a touchdown in the third quarter. They gave him a 14-point lead. Bryce Young tried to lead Alabama back, but it was not good enough. And for the first time in 100 tries, Alabama lost to an unranked team. I don't think Alabama's out of the playoff mix because, again, as long as they win out and beat Georgia in the SEC championship, they're going to be in the playoff. But there are concerns about Alabama's defense. Their schedule going forward gives them opportunities for wins. They end the year with Arkansas at home in their second-to-last game and then end the year at Auburn. And Tennessee's coming up next week. That could be a really good game considering Tennessee and Josh Heupel's got that offense clicking. So it's not exactly a guarantee Alabama's going to run the table. There are question marks, but I don't really think one game is going to knock them out of the playoff. They did beat Ole Miss early in the year. They have a win over Florida. The Miami win doesn't look as good, but they do have a couple good wins. I think as long as Alabama runs the table, they will be fine. Oklahoma beating Texas in a wild game, 55-48. Texas was dominant in the first quarter. You saw the Casey Thompson, Xavier Worthy connection. Texas was in cruise control in this game. And Lincoln Riley made a bold move. He went to a freshman in Caleb Williams, benched Spencer Rattler, and Williams, who you go off that report that the Oklahoma student newspaper had, we haven't had them on yet this year, maybe we'll work on that, that it looked like Caleb Williams is getting the first team reps in practice. So it sounds like Spencer Rattler is getting benched, and Williams brought more of that spark. He was running the football, big chunk plays down the field to Marvin Mims. And Oklahoma's finding a way to make a good comeback. And I still am not sold on Oklahoma. I still don't think that they are a playoff team because eventually they're going to have to blow somebody out. And Oklahoma just has been playing close games all year, and you're going to get burned by that at some point. But that was still an impressive win and a gut-wrenching loss for Texas. One of the entertaining games of the week, though, was in Ole Miss. Rebels with a high-scoring 52-51 win over Arkansas. Matt Corral had 2 touchdowns. Arkansas, I liked the decision to go for 2. It did not work, but it was a really good, entertaining game that Ole Miss seemed to find a way to win, so give Lane Kiffin's team a lot of credit for that. Iowa hangs on to beat Penn State. Not a pretty game, but you're used to that in the Big Ten. But the Hawkeyes have put themselves in a great position to make the playoff. They don't really have a lot of tough games left on their schedule. Penn State still has Ohio State, still has Michigan State, so don't rule out Penn State yet. But Iowa gets a big win at home. Georgia rolls over Auburn 34-10. Bulldogs are absolutely in cruise control right now. Their defense is elite, but a tough game this week hosting Kentucky. Kentucky's a ranked team. They blew out LSU over the weekend. And we'll hopefully, for Student Section Showdown, be featuring Kentucky and Georgia. That game at 3:30 Eastern Saturday on CBS. Notre Dame survived in a late field goal to beat Virginia Tech. Michigan wins on the road in Lincoln over Nebraska. So, yeah, Michigan in good form. Kind of flying under the radar still. And I also think a team you got to keep an eye on, Wake Forest. I don't think they'll make the playoff, but they're undefeated in the ACC, which I think people thought that would be Clemson, but it's not. And Wake Forest going forward, their only ranked game left is at home against NC State. They do have to go to Clemson, the second to last game of the season. They go to Boston College to end the year, but keep an eye on Wake Forest. They got Army this week on the road. Always tricky when you go to Army, but Wake Forest, tough win. They've been winning some close games, so Demon Deacons having one of their better seasons in a long time. So as we look ahead to eventually top games for this week, there's not many ranked versus ranked games. You have the Kentucky-Georgia game we mentioned and Oklahoma State at Texas. There are some good other matchups like Arizona State at Utah, Oklahoma hosting TCU, Ole Miss at Tennessee, Purdue is at Iowa, BYU, if they're losing to Boise State, can they bounce back now that their chance at the playoff is probably done? They go to Baylor. Good game for Baylor. Maybe they bounce back. And Arkansas against Auburn is a good game. And Cincinnati-UCF. Remember, Gus Malzahn maybe has some tricks up his sleeve for the Bearcats. So we'll give you our top five games coming up Saturday morning. And we'll do that for the NFL as well and play Week 6 Word Association. So coming up next, we have our thoughts on what Kyrie Irving had to say on Instagram Live. And some news about baseball. We'll look back at the ALDS, look ahead to the ALCS, look ahead to Game 5 tonight, and a shocking firing that happened as we're recording this show in St. Louis. We're going to dive into all that coming up next on Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio. Ken's said to talk about Kyrie Irving here on Kicking It with Keeler. As we heard about the news, Kyrie Irving right now is not going to be with the Nets until either things change with the mandate in New York City or until he decides to get the vaccine. And Kyrie Irving decided on Wednesday night to hop on Instagram Live and voiced his opinions on what he feels about the situation. I looked at a couple of his statements and I did listen to some of it. And basically, I'll try to sum it up as best I can. He's not an anti-vaxxer. I think he's more anti-mandate than anti-vaxxer. And believe me, I understand people that are frustrated in places like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles with the vaccine mandate. I understand that. But if you're Kyrie Irving and you're out there saying that you support people that are losing their jobs, what about the people that have lost their lives because of COVID? He says that he tries to make himself look like a victim in this case. And believe me, it's not, I'm sure it's not an easy decision for people to decide whether they want to get the vaccine or not. We've talked about that so much on this show. And I look at Kyrie and what I see, as much as I try to understand him, that to me, he's still a selfish basketball player. And I feel like he's been that way ever since he left LeBron. Remember, he left LeBron to be his own, to be the leader, to be the guy. And it blew up in his face in Boston. And it's kind of blown up in his face here in Brooklyn. And I think in this situation, when you look at Kyrie Irving, he's not putting the best interest of the basketball team in his mind. Now, the Nets can still win the championship without him. They've got Kevin Durant. They've got James Harden. They have a good group of players surrounding him. But you look at this group of players, like, you need Kyrie Irving in the fold. And what was striking about what he said on Instagram Live last night, he said he was expecting to get an exemption. Now, I don't know where he might have thought he would have got the exemption from. And I think when you look at the Nets, maybe they tried to get him an exemption behind the scenes. I have no proof of that. But maybe that's where the Nets said, you know what, we tried to do everything for you, Kyrie. Please help us out. And he's not going to do that. Remember, this is a guy that left for a couple weeks last year because of racial injustice and basically left and didn't tell anybody at first. He's out for himself. That's why I find it hard to believe when Sham Sharania from The Athletic talk about he's a voice for the voiceless. To me, that was BS. At least he finally went on Instagram Live, although he could have talked to the media, but he thinks the media is stupid. He thinks we're all pawns. He thinks he's smarter than all of us. He's not. He's his own unique individual. And look, I'm not criticizing Kyrie for that. Be unique. Be your own person. I get that. But you don't get the financial consequences, Kyrie, because you're still getting paid even if you don't play on the road. Maybe you don't get paid for the home games you miss, but you're getting paid on the road. The people that are choosing to not take the vaccine and are losing their jobs are not getting paid a dime. You're still getting paid. Maybe you should give some of that money you're gonna keep for not playing. Maybe you give it to somebody. And he's not a bad person. He does great things. I've seen the list of great things Kyrie Irving does. It doesn't make him a bad person. But it's a selfish act. It is. Look out for the good of the people. Look out for the good of your team. Be a part of a team, Kyrie, not be a part of yourself. Part of the reason why people get the vaccine is to look out for other people, not just themselves. And Kyrie's saying he's being judged and demonized for it, and he just wants the hoop. Come on. You're a public figure. You're an athlete. You're on the center stage. People come to watch you play. Your case is obviously going to get more recognition than if you're a fireman or a doctor or a teacher or anything like that, because you're a celebrity. You have influence. It's how you use that influence that determines whether or not you're a great role model to people or not. But I think Kyrie at this point is going to wait it out. He's going to hope that there's a new mayor. There is going to be a new mayor in New York City in the next couple months. But he's going to hope that eventually the mandate gets lifted and he's going to get to play. And maybe it will. Again, we don't know what direction this virus is going to take this world. We don't know that. But to take that risk, I mean, I would get why Kevin Durant or James Harden would be not happy. And maybe they're kind of relieved that that distraction is kind of away for a while. And then just focus on playing basketball starting Tuesday night in Milwaukee. But for right now, Kyrie Irving, in my mind, out of sight, out of mind. And to me, when you look at his Instagram Live and all that stuff, the stance he tried to give was not as clear as you would have hoped. Let's put it that way. You wanted to take one direction with it. You kind of just went off in many different directions, and nobody's saying he's anti-vaxxer, but I saw the Michael Kay show. Michael Kay brings this up all the time. Kyrie Irving was at a WNBA game in a vaccinated section as a non-vaccinated person. So, again, I don't believe that he's anti-vaccine, but I think at the same time, you look at Kyrie Irving, and to me, out of sight, out of mind. You don't want to play? You don't want to play. That's your decision. I respect the decision. But at the same time, I have the right, as Stephen A. Smith said on ESPN and a bunch of others have said, you have the, with every decision comes consequences. With every decision comes some form of criticism. And this decision to me speaks of, I think to me, he's selfish. From a basketball standpoint, not a human perspective, from a basketball player perspective, he is selfish in letting down his team. I've said that from the very beginning with him. And I don't think you can trade him. He said last night he's not going to retire. I don't think a team would want to take on that headache. I think the Nets only took on this headache because Kevin Durant wanted him. And the only way Kevin Durant was going to Brooklyn was to bring Kyrie Irving with him. But it's a mess. I don't think it will derail Brooklyn's shot at a championship, though. I still think they're the favorites. But I think you got a clearer picture, a lack of a clear picture when it comes to Kyrie Irving. So we'll take one more break. We will come back. We'll look at tonight's Game 5 of the NLDS and a shocking decision made by the Dodgers. We'll look ahead to Astros, Red Sox, and the ALCS and the shocking firing in St. Louis that you wonder what's going on from a Cardinal team that had such a great run to get to the postseason. Now they're looking for a new head guy. You're listening to Kicking with Keeler here on Full Press Radio. We'll wrap up this episode after this. Wrapping up episode 104 of Kicking with Keeler, talking a little hockey and a little baseball. And I was, one, very excited to get hockey back on ESPN. I love the theme music. It's something I always watched in the late 90s, early 2000s. We talked about it when they first got the news that it was going back to ESPN. I remember waiting for Baseball Tonight to come on and watching a Ducks Stars. It was like a 5-overtime playoff game. And I love playoff hockey in general, but there's something when the sport's on ESPN, it brings more prestige. I mean, I can relate it to where when the Big East now is on FS1 and ESPN barely talks about Big East basketball anymore. So when you get hockey on ESPN, it means people have to talk hockey because it's on your network. So to have that back, and TNT I thought was really cool. It was a casual style of broadcast. You had the cool TV studio with Liam McHugh, Wayne Gretzky, Paul Bissonnette, Rick Tockett, Anson Carter. They did a really good job. It had that inside the NBA kind of feel to it. You had the rink on the set too, where like they could show plays and different things like that. It was definitely a fascinating experience. And for ESPN, I liked that they had two different styles of broadcast. You had one with Sean McDonough and Ray Ferraro, where it was more of a play-by-play narrative kind of broadcast. You had Emily Kaplan, who's a reporter, inside the glass. And then when the Kraken played the Golden Knights in the late broadcast, you had John Buchegras, Brian Boucher, and AJ Molesko. And it was more of a, they kept talking the analytics, but the intrinsic, the different things about the game, the strategy, and all this stuff as the play is going on. They didn't wait until after the play was over. So I thought it was really cool. You had TNT had the power play timer on the ice. You had the player movement tracker. So there are some things like TNT's broadcast, I think, is going to be designed if you're new into hockey. You can kind of get into it a little bit more. ESPN, I think, is more for the diehard hockey fan. But both, I think, had good showings in their first night of the season. Some takeaways from those games. Again, I'm not the biggest NHL expert, but I'll give you the best I can, and we'll try to bring on hockey guests throughout the season to talk about it. I was very impressed by the Penguins. It was opening night in Tampa Bay, big atmosphere, Lightning are getting the Stanley Cup banner, and John Cooper, their coach, said it best. One team came to play, the other team came to watch a banner. And the Penguins did that with 6 goals. They won 6-2, all of them coming after the first period, so a very entertaining hockey game. And then the Golden Knights against the Kraken. Kraken get down 3-0 in the second period, and Seattle rallies. Ryan Donato is the answer to the famous trivia question, who scores the first goal in Kraken history? But McCann scores, Morgan Geeky scores, all of a sudden it's 3-3, you got a game. And I still find it weird with Chandler Stephenson. There's a play in the third period where Stephenson gets the goal and he angles his skate. He doesn't kick the puck into the net, but he angles his skate to deflect it into the net. It's not illegal. I get why. I heard Brian Boucher kind of argue like, well, if you want goals in the sport, we can't really make those kind of things illegal. But isn't still angling your skate kind of kicking it into the net in a way? I find it odd that goal counted. I understand if you're a Kraken fan that would upset you. But good showing by Seattle to rally from 3-0 down when they're not known for scoring goals. So the Golden Knights get a win at home. And always their pregame entertainment is fantastic. In terms of the TNT broadcast, I'm shocked the Rangers went with Georgiev instead of Shestorkin. I know they play tonight, so Shestorkin starts the home opener. But why are you not playing your goalie back-to-back to start the season? I have no clue. They went for more of a tougher lineup in the offseason, and I'm not packing after one game if you're a Ranger fan, but the Capitals just went out and played hockey. The Rangers tried to out-tough somebody, and Washington was just a better team. TJ Oshie scored late in the first period on a power play. 2 goals from Alex Ovechkin in the third period. He now is, I think, 5th all-time, passing Marcel Dion on the goals list, so Washington wins. Blackhawks were down 3-0 early to Colorado. Marc-Andre Fleury had a rough go of it. in the first period. They did rally to make it a game, but it was 4-2. Colorado picked up the victory. So I really enjoyed those two games. Obviously, more hockey games coming up, but that was the ESPN TNT games. Quickly looking ahead to the baseball. ALCS is set for tomorrow night, 8 o'clock Eastern on Fox. Astros at Red Sox, and bad news for the Astros, who, I'll give them credit, they slugged their way to the series. They pounded the White Sox pitching staff. But Lance McCullers, who's arguably the ace of their staff, is likely out for the ALCS due to forearm tightness. Dusty Baker said earlier today the lefty Framber Valdez will start game one tomorrow. Luis Garcia, one of the top rookies in the American League, will start on Saturday. Valdez has good numbers against Boston this year. Astros are 5-2 against the Red Sox. Valdez went 2-0 with a 1.26 ERA, 18 strikeouts, 2 walks over the course of 14 in the third innings, ERA of 1.26. I wouldn't totally count the Astros out, but obviously I think they feed off of the enemy kind of thing. But I think you look at the Red Sox, to me they're on a mission right now. And what I like about the Red Sox in this kind of game, they beat the Rays in 4. They get the 13-inning win with the controversial play that bounced off Renfro back into the seats, and they call it a ground rule double where Diaz can't score. Boston ended up winning on a 2-run homer, but you could argue the game kind of changes if Tampa has the lead in the 13th, but it is the rules. They got it right by the letter of the law. So they went on that, and they went on a walk-off the walk-off sack fly by Kike Hernandez in game 4, who absolutely is a difference maker for this team. You think about all the great postseason moments Hernandez was a part of with the Dodgers, and he comes in, he's really one of the only differences on this Red Sox team from a year ago. But he can play all over the diamond, can play the outfield. He made the great defensive play off the monster in the wild card game against the Yankees. He's done so many different things for this team that he's a spark plug, and Devers has broken out. Martinez, Verdugo, the list goes on and on. This team can hit. So I think when you look at this pitching, this matchup, it's a battle of the offenses. Because Boston has Eovaldi, who's been good. But Sale, you wonder if Cora's even going to pitch him as a rotation member in this series. Pivetta and Rodriguez are not guys you count on. So it comes down to the bullpens. And Boston, I think Cora can use his guys as starters, as relievers. Maybe not all the time in the best of 7, but he can kind of go that direction. Garrett Whitlock's been improving as he gets more reps, and you've got Matt Barnes on the roster now, and Robles has been great down the stretch. You have Ottavino. There's different ways the Red Sox can go, and I never want to count the Astros, but I think you look at the managerial edge in the series, I think Cora has it over Baker. Cora, to me, speaks to how important a manager can be, because the Red Sox were nothing without him last year. They bring him back, and all of a sudden, they're a different team, and they're trying to make it back to the World Series for the first time since 2018. Now, I've seen it named in the American League Cheaters Series. Of course, Astros from 2017, Red Sox from 2018. If you're a Yankee fan, I don't blame you if you don't want to watch this series. I can totally understand it. You're mad at whoever wins. I think you have to root for the Astros, though. You can't root for the Red Sox to make it to the World Series. But to me, personally, I'm rooting for Dusty Baker to get to the World Series for the first time since 2002. I think if you told me that all Dusty Baker had to do was get to the World Series to be a Hall of Famer, I would absolutely root for it. He's a player's guy. He's been great for the game. And the one thing that you have to at least give Dusty credit for, he knows how to manage a bullpen, especially remember Houston had a lot of young relievers last year. They got within a win of the World Series. So they're used to this atmosphere. They're used to the hostility. They get home field advantage. But I'm going to lean Boston in 6. I think they're I think they're better with the starting rotation, and I think with the McCullers injury, I mean, does Zach Greinke give you anything in long relief? Do they even bring back Jake Odorizzi for this series? I just think Boston with Eovaldi, maybe Sale, Pivetta, and Rodriguez is good enough. So I think Boston, by the strength of their offense and their starting pitching, win this in a close 6-game series. Then tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern, TBS, Game 5, Dodgers-Giants. Winner faces the Braves, who I was not surprised they beat Milwaukee in 4. Freddie Freeman with the home run off Josh Hader, who very quietly has had some rough postseason moments the last couple of years. We rip on Chapman, fairly rip on Hader to some extent. But Atlanta advances based on their offense, and their bullpen actually is really good in this series. But Dodgers-Giants tonight, and the weird decision Dave Roberts made is he is going to Corey Knebel as an opener and not starting Julio Urias. Now, Urias, who's a 20-game winner, one game two, is going to pitch after Knebel. But we get into this stupidity, and I call it stupidity. I get why analytics exist, but why are the teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers saying, oh, we got to start an opener? You have a 20-game winner on your pitching staff. You have a guy in Urias who has been a part of a World Series club last year, was huge for them in big games. One game two for you when you desperately needed to win after Logan Webb, the guy who's starting for the Giants tonight, dominated you for 7 2/3 innings in game one with a slider and changeup. And just the fact that you have to start Knebel so the Giants don't go a certain way with their lineup, come on. It's ridiculous. And I criticized the Yankees for this last year when they decided to only pitch their stud young pitcher, Davey Garcia, for an inning, when bringing Jay Happ because they wanted the race, some different. But everybody's got analytics. The Giants aren't stupid. The Giants also have analytics. They've got Farhan Zaidi and Gabe Kapler. You think they don't understand what the Dodgers are trying to do? It's like one big giant game, either a chess or chicken. I don't know what it is. This is game five. Play your best and let's go. If Julio Urías is one of your better starting pitchers, let him go 5-6 innings. And that's why I said when we got into the last segment, we led into this one, I miss the days of when you just threw ace on ace, 2-1, seventh inning, both pitchers are dealing, you strike out 10, let's go. Now it's all, we can't have guys pitch three times through the order. And you know why? That's why I loved the Charlie Morton-Corbin Burns matchup in the Brave Brewers series. Both were dealing zeros till the seventh inning. And you had in that series in game three, Freddy Peralta's dealing, but because it's 2-0 Braves in the fifth, he's got to come out on 57 pitches. That's ridiculous. But that's the playoffs. That's the new way of managing in the playoffs. You just have to accept it. When it comes to tonight's game, though, what I'm looking for is when the Dodgers' offense, especially the top of the order, have success against Logan Webb. When the Dodgers are clicking on all cylinders, they're getting it from Mookie Betts, Corey Seager, and Trey Turner. Mix in a little bit of Justin Turner, mix in a little bit of Bellinger, I think, has had a better series. And it's definitely maybe not been the guy he once was, but he's at least decent. But it's the top of that lineup. And for the Giants, I'm looking at guys like Posey and Bryant and Crawford. Who are the heroes? We mentioned both these teams can have a hero, different hero on a different night. My X-Factor for the Giants, for example, late night Lamont Wade. Either with a defensive player, does something late in the game. I like the Dodgers in five coming into the series. I think the Dodgers will win this game. Something along the lines like 5-4. I think it'll be close. These two teams have been tight all season long, as I mentioned earlier. They played 23 times. The Giants are 12-11. So it would not surprise me if the Dodgers, if the Giants win this game. I think they would have really earned a lot, because I think you look at the Dodgers, they can be more creative with their bullpen, right? You've got Knebel's opening, which I hate it, but he's opening. You got Urias probably from the second to about the fifth or the sixth. And at least at that point, the Dodgers can use Joe Kelly. They can use Bruce Dar-Gratterall. They could use Blake Treinen. They can use Kenley Jansen. There's more options available to them. The Giants, their middle relief kind of got exposed in game four. They used nine pitchers. They didn't use any of their top guys, but I think the Kapler's going to be more reluctant to go to the middle relief. So you're looking at maybe Logan Webb, Kevin Gausman. We saw Camilo Duvall get six outs in game three. I would not be shocked if they try to get six outs out of him tonight, mixing McGee and Rogers in the mix as well. But the Giants are not going to go to the middle of their bullpen. If anything, Kevin Gausman will get the pitch. And that's one where you worry about, can he handle being a reliever in that big situation where this could be the last game he pitches before a big contract? The Dodgers, to me, I would not pitch Scherzer unless I absolutely had to. We saw Scherzer in 2017 pitching Game 5 against the Cubs, and he was not the same pitcher in relief. We've seen him have success as well in relief in the postseason, but I don't think Scherzer should be in that situation now. I think you've got Urias, and since you're using the opener, unless Urias absolutely flounders and you're trying to salvage something, I don't think Scherzer, you will see Max Scherzer tonight. I think the Dodgers will have him ready in case they have to go to Atlanta for Game 1 on Saturday. Which, again, we will preview both. We'll recap game one of the ALCS and preview the NLCS on our next show Saturday morning. So keep that in mind. Very quickly to wrap it up, Yankees making some coaching changes. Marcus Thames, PJ Pletary, and Phil Nevin out. Thames and Pletary were the hitting coaches. Phil Nevin, the third base coach. So it makes you wonder, is Aaron Boone going to come back with the coaching staff basically being reshuffled by the Yankees and Brendan Cuddy from NJ.com reported dictated by the Yankees? Or is Boone just going to say, that's it, I'm out, and either go to another job or who knows? So I think there's still some news to come with the Yankees. And the shocking news I referred to a lot over the last few segments, the bombshell news that Mike Schilt is out as St. Louis Cardinals manager. Now, that is shocking because the Cardinals, we mentioned, won 17 in a row, got to the wild card game. I don't think Schilt really did anything to lose the wild card game either. That was a well-played game. The Dodgers were just better. And frankly, I think deserved to win because of their regular season success. But John Mozeliak, the Cardinals president, said he fired Mike Schilt due to a philosophical difference in the direction of the team. We decided internally it would be best to separate now. Schilt had 1 year left on his deal, and if you listen to the Mozeliak press conference, basically they had their organizational meetings and something went wrong in the last 5 days that changed their mind. So Schilt is out. That's another great candidate on the market. If you're a team like the Mets or the Padres or a team looking for a manager, Mike Schilt would make a lot of sense. Because he succeeded in a place in St. Louis that's really only seen two managers in the last, like, 20 years, La Russa and Mike Matheny. Both won World Series. And it makes you wonder, and I know philosophical differences aside, St. Louis is becoming one of the tougher managing spots in baseball. You don't get rid of managers that easy in St. Louis. It's a baseball town. They're diehard fans. But is the pressure to winning in St. Louis? Now you're following three guys in the last 20 years that have had success. I mean, Mike Schilt didn't win a championship, but got him to the postseason. I mean, look at Aaron Boone with the Yankees. Got him to the postseason every year, but at some point, even in New York, there's still the championship or bust mentality in some way that makes you think Aaron Boone's doing a bad job. And I said back in the wildcard game, I think Aaron Boone's 50-50 to come back. I don't know what to make of his situation. But right now, the Met job is available. I think Schilt would be a good candidate there. Padre job is available. I think he'd be a good candidate there. Obviously, he can't go to St. Louis, but keep an eye on the Houston situation with Dusty. Does he go back for one more year? So there are good options out there. And again, the Yankee job, if it opens up, is a good option as well. Although I think Cashman would go to a more analytic guy and a less proven guy, although I'd want the Yankees to hire experience over analytics. But again, I like analytics, but I don't love analytics, as you all know. But that definitely surprised me today. So I want to remind you, of course, you can follow me on Twitter, at RickNator555. It's at R-I-C-K, letter I, Nader, like a Terminator, and 3 5s. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, at FP underscore coverage, and at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you're at your podcast, just search Full Kickin' McKeel, or chances are you will find it. Be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free, so be sure to check that out. Again, go to pinstripeprospects.com for all your Yankees minor league information. And Barrett Sports Media have a couple cool articles out. One, Ryan Russillo talking about his career in sports radio with Brian Curtis. And I also did a story on Jeff Van Gundy talking about how he's more cognizant about not criticizing officials as much. And I also think I'm going to do a story for Friday on Dick Vitale's interview with Chris Fowler. Or Chris Fowler was talking to Dick Vitale. Some cool stuff in that interview I'm going to write about as well. So thanks for all for tuning in. Enjoy Thursday Night Football tonight. Enjoy Game 5 of Dodgers-Giants. Enjoy the hockey. Thanks for kicking it with me, Ricky Keogh, on a Thursday night. And I will see you back here Saturday morning for NFL preview, college football preview, looking at the LCSs in baseball, and so much more as October is in full swing. Until then, enjoy, everybody.